too want to thank the organizers. Thank you so much for putting this together. I feel like the caveman in the ads for the insurance company. I can't speak your language. My involvement in mathematical modeling was as a result of my association with the Systems and Design Engineering Department at Case Institute when I was in Cleveland, and it took us 2 years of 2 hours a week to be able to even begin to talk about the same language and speak the same language. So this is just a first step in our understanding of each other's problems, and it's vitally important. Whenever a neurosurgeon thought about a problem, he thought it was a problem of mathematics and engineering, and any time an engineer thought about a problem, it was biology, because you couldn't, neither one of us could understand the other. Now, I have been working on this, beginning with my relationship at Case, for 30 years, and with a series of experiments and observations driven by this model. And the bottom line is there's no such thing as communicating hydrocephalus. Now, the stimulus, interestingly enough, to my work was because Ben Kaufman, who is a neuroradiologist at Case, was a passionate believer in pulsatility and the importance of the pulse wave, and his papers on the effect of chronic hydrocephalus and shunting on the skull and brain were really a very important understanding of these sorts of things. Bering, and we've heard of the Bering and DeRocco experiments, where the augmentation of the pulse wave, simulating an extension of the choroid plexus pulsations, led to hydrocephalus in itself. And therefore, I felt very strongly that we had to understand pulsations in order to be able to understand hydrocephalus. Well, the truth, we have to understand pulsations in order to understand Bering and DeRocco, but that's all. There are three sets of experiments implicated. Augmentation of the pulse wave was extremely important in the pathophysiology of hydrocephalus. All three postulated the choroid plexus was the source of the pulse wave that led to the hydrocephalus. In all three, the systolic pulse would lead to an outward displacement of the ventricular wall when the choroid plexus distended. So there are a couple of things that also led me to be very interested in this problem. This paper that I wrote in 1980, I should use a second to explain about the ependema. This is a patient in whom there was a ventricular catheter, ventricular reservoir in place with some of the holes in the ventricle and some of the holes not in the ventricle. And the patient had been a patient who had a posterior fossa craniotomy, a big pseudomeningocele. And in those days, with the EMI scanner, you actually wrapped the head in a constrictive wrap. And so the patient was put in the scanner, and the head was wrapped, and it pushed the CSF back into the head. And the patient got off the table with a complete hemiplegia, contralateral to the area where the ventricular catheter was. And when you looked at the scan, there was a complete whiteout of the brain. It was absolutely wet on the side in which there was a ventricular catheter, and there was a completely normal hemisphere on the other side. So CSF had been forced through that standpipe into the parenchyma. And so at least in that particular case, there was a selective wetting of the white matter of the brain versus the one that had an intact ependema. Somehow the ependema was able to keep CSF out of the parenchyma. So what do we do with the model? This is a simple way of looking at how we put this thing together. But this, I think, is the important thing. What does a model do? And I shouldn't talk, this is a general talk, but I think we expect too much of mathematical models. We expect them to give us the answer rather than pose the question. And all that mathematical models are, in my view, are rigid examples of how to test inductive reasoning. They're a good tool of inductive reasoning. And so this is the pathways that you can go. If I have an idea and I have a model, I put the idea in, it works. Well, that's a very weak curve, because you could put in a whole bunch of things and it'll give you the right answer. But if you get a wrong answer, then that's really a value, because then you either have to change the model or you have to design experiments to figure out why you screwed up, what was wrong with what you said. So this is why a model, I think, is very valuable, and if we can get these models together, I think we can really make some real progress. The mathematical descriptions of what happens, that thing at the bottom is true. It's just like the idea of accountants at Enron. Accountants can make anything look like anything they want to, and mathematicians can make anything look like anything they want to. There are mathematical equations that'll describe the changes in anything. But if you do it in a very, very rigid way, it can really improve your ability to be inductive, to have inductive reasoning. Now, I changed the title of this, and you can probably think of what the title might have been of this slide, if those of you who know me. But let's assume that I'm reviewing an article for the Journal of Neurosurgery, and it's on mathematical modeling, or the assumptions made from mathematical modeling. The first thing you need is you need to have an assumption of what the mathematical model is going to tell you. And so that's what you get all the time. This is the way I put this model together. This is my assumptions of what it's going on. And then Deus ex machina, a god comes out of a machine to answer the question. And it's like you're watching CSI Miami, and a person comes out with an unknown twin brother that the guy never had. That's the reason that that all of the DNA testing is the same. So it's a sudden awareness, and you just leap to an answer. And I see that all the time in reviewing articles, and all of them will say, well, this supports the idea of pulsations. The other thing is that all of these pulsatility models talk about ventricular distension as a result of damage to the brain. But if you notice, when a shunt fails, and you put it back and you fix it, and you can get them back to the scanner, we have now an MRI, an intraoperative MRI scan. You can't even ask the machine to start, and the ventricles can come down. So not all ventricular distension has to do with destruction of brain tissue or even injury to brain tissue. It's simply an elastic material that's been distended. So what are the requirements of the model? We put in what we knew about the anatomy, and we needed it to be able to predict pseudotumor cerebri and normal pressure hydrocephalus. And we wanted it useful in developing and analyzing physiologic experiments that validated the model or challenged the model and provide a better understanding of the pathophysiology of hydrocephalus. Why a bulk flow circuit model? The reason is because the mathematics was too complicated for me to even come close to putting into a pulsatility model. So we started off with simple things for which there was good information. It allowed us to design laboratory experiments that were much more straightforward, and we had the tools to do these things. We felt very strongly that this was just the first step of something that we'd have to go to before, because we expected to hit a wall almost immediately that we couldn't explain using bulk flow. We used the hydraulic equivalent of Ohm's law, and we put all of these things in it. At the beginning, we talked about the brain reacting passively to changes in ventricular volume, but we thought of the brain as a viscoelastic substance. The spinal subarachnoid space was outside the constraint of the skull, but the cortical subarachnoid space was inside. And this is what it looked like. We created the skull, and the thing that's driving me crazy now is that we've really never looked at this cortical subarachnoid space. And the more I look at it and the more I review the problems of hydrocephalus, the more important that becomes. So we are, this is the history of the NIH's support for this. Now, the analysis of the role of choroid plexus in generating hydrocephalus. We started with normal greyhound dogs instrumented with ICP monitors and an interventricular balloon. The Electronics Design Center case created an amplifier from a hi-fi amplifier and was able to generate any form of a waveform that you would want. And we created a force opposite to the pulse wave that was created by the intracranial pressure work. So and we created this opposite 180 degree out of phase pulse wave, and then measured the volume of displacement that it took to balance the pulse wave. And it was between 2 and 3 orders of magnitude greater than you could possibly explain by the changes in the volume of the choroid plexus or the amount of CSF produced by the choroid plexus, which sort of showed us that the problem of the choroid plexus expansion, which is what Spertel and DeGrocco were all about, was really the erectile nature of the brain with its arterial input into it. And I don't know where that leads to Rocco and Bering, which I still haven't been able to understand those two experiments. So we started looking at the CSF compartment as a circuit, a hydraulic circuit diagram, and so we spent the next 2 or 3 years actually measuring each of those compartments with intracranial pressure monitors that were given to me by the Department of Engineering at Case. And we've produced these articles on the circuit diagram, and this is what we found. I have put pressure transducers in just about every place you can imagine, and when you look at the pressures, no matter what you do to them, by blowing up balloons or infusing artificial CSF or whatever you can do, you cannot measure a pressure differential anywhere, except between the cortical subarachnoid space and the superior sagittal sinus. There is no measurable, by our currently available techniques, there's no measurable pressure differential anywhere. We could not measure transmetal pressures at any pressure. The only pressure we could measure differently was between the intracranial compartment and the sagittal sinus.
How accurate was it? What's your minimum?
Well, the what you can buy is plus or minus 1 torr. And they had a few of them that got down to 0.2 torr, but we still couldn't get anything. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, but I'm saying that within our ability to measure, they don't exist. And if you're talking about hydrocephalus and the changes with big changes in intracranial pressure, then it has to be because there's movement of the brain outward. There's a distension of the brain itself rather than the maintenance of a pressure differential. So when we've done all this, I'm trying to bring down 30 years into one 20-minute or 19-minute talk, is that we felt that NPH and pseudotumor were the things we had to do, and what we decided was that there had to be something that had to do with the change in the stiffness of the brain, and how to call that. I've been calling it TERGR because, as far as I know, there's not a specific name that measures, and maybe with the elastometry that we've seen, this is the kind of thing that I need this elastometry for, to measure the viscoelastic property of a living brain. Thank you. Originally, we've gone through a lot of iterations, and we thought it was a constant, but it's clearly related mostly to intracranial venous volume or intracranial blood volume. So in order to our first attempts to try to figure out the stiffness of the brain, or this case would be, is, and you all are engineers and I'm not, or a lot of you are anyway, we put a balloon in the subarachnoid space and blew it up. So we were measuring the pulse wave and the absolute pressure, the mean pressure, and the pressure differential at all of these compartments all over, and then we would suddenly blow up the balloon. And immediately, with no delay, there was a movement, the pressure was sensed the same in all compartments at the same time with no change in pulse amplitude, which implies that it's pure water. Is that not correct? It implies that it's absolutely incompressible and there is no change. So Dr. Raimondi, walking into a dinner, said, you know how that's interesting, but could it ever help anybody? My wife was there, thank God, because I didn't deck him.
I did.
But I've had a lot of fun with him since. Anyway, I threw these in to just, this is lumbar drainage in acute and severe pediatric head injury, which models like pseudotumor cerebri, and we have been, now it's accepted as one of the second tier therapies for managing severe head injury patients for intractable increased intracranial pressure. We have several other things that we've done, but the most important part of this talk is what is communicating hydrocephalus. And this is the way we look at the intracranial compartment, and it's very odd, and it looks like a third ventriculostomy is a very short distance. But if you look at it, it should be looked at like this, like a circuit diagram. And Rantzau's name was used today, and I think it's really been ignored, and it's really an important concept. Instead of using Dandy's classification, which was communicating and non-communicating hydrocephalus, Rantzau said we should use the terms intraventricular obstructive hydrocephalus and extraventricular obstructive hydrocephalus, and we should get rid of the term communicating. It was in 1960, and I don't know anybody else, I haven't seen anybody else quote it except me, but it's really, really important, because if you look at communicating hydrocephalus, the usual causes are meningitis, hemorrhage, and normal pressure hydrocephalus. If you look at the pathology, where is the pathology? Well, primarily it's between the spinal subarachnoid space and the cortical subarachnoid space. It's thickening of the arachnoid at the base of the skull. The old cisternograms that they used in the I-131 cisternograms or whatever it is, the dye studies, it went into the ventricle and stayed there for 2 or 3 days and had a lot of trouble percolating over the top. Well, that's because there's a blockage at the base of the skull, and that's been shown pathologically. So what is a third ventriculostomy? A third ventriculostomy is a bypass all the way from the third ventricle all the way to the cortical subarachnoid space, bypassing the basal cisterns and bypassing the... So that just the fact that you have a big fourth ventricle doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to respond to an endoscopic third ventriculostomy. The fact that you respond to an endoscopic third ventriculostomy is not magic. It's simply the fact that this is an obstruction at the base of the skull. That shouldn't have been in there. Now, I'm not defining the point of obstruction in hydrocephalus, which we now have the tools to do. Dandy did not have the tools, and all he could do was inject dye in the head and do a spinal tap. That was the only test he could do. Then we had air studies, then we had all these other things, but now we have the tools to non-invasively measure, find out where the point of obstruction is. In all hydrocephalus, there is an obstruction. And the obstruction has to prevent the only time that it can be in the final absorption pathway is in a child with an expanding head. If you block your superior sagittal, the flow from the subarachnoid space into the sagittal sinus or into the lymphatics, wherever it is to be absorbed, you will not get hydrocephalus. You'll get a form of pseudotumor, and you'll get dilatation of the cortical subarachnoid space, not of the ventricles. But if a baby does that, they'll get hydrocephalus because the head can grow.
That after subarachnoid hemorrhage, the patient gets NPH?
That's the subarachnoid hemorrhage. the initial effect of a subarachnoid hemorrhage is a clogging here in the
periventricular, in the... It's at the base of the brain, where you just described.
Yeah. But as they develop, as they get rid of the TGF-beta is released from the platelets and they get the scarring and all of that, all of the thing is at the base of the skull. And that causes hydrocephalus because it's down here. But it's not between the third ventricle and the interventricular cistern, which can then get to the point of absorption. So, all...
Down to the preponting area and then up and around the base of the skull?
What?
I mean, how is it going?
How is what going?
I mean, if you closed off the base of the skull, I always said I did my third ventricular ostomy into the space below that.
No, it's in the interventricular cistern. It's up higher, above. And we can prove that with dye studies, and we do that all the time. And you can show that it doesn't get into, it'll get into the fourth ventricle of spinal subarachnoid space, but it doesn't get in. I do that a lot. All of the aneurysms have EVDs in place. You put a little dye in. It goes down into the spinal subarachnoid space, but doesn't get into the interventricular cistern. I'm sorry if I...
If you clarify what you meant. Yeah.
Okay.
But you're re-admitting on yourself.
I am. Okay, these are my rules. All compartments containing CSF must communicate with each other with either endoscopic fenestration or multiple catheters that are spliced proximal to the valve. And the pressures should be between 5 and 15 and minus 5 and plus 5. As far as treating these patients are concerned. Now, the original NIH grant application included the treatment of hydrocephalus with a shunt to a closed balloon to damp the pressure. My original concepts of all of this were find a way to damp a pulse pressure so that you could treat hydrocephalus with damping of the pressure. Gary Magram's accumulator shunt is a similar sort of thing, and maybe there's a natural or a model of that with a ventricular subgarial shunt. But practically speaking, hydrocephalus is obstructive, and it's explained by the by bulk flow and. Pulsatility is important in that it supplies a huge amount of energy for ventricular distension, not because it injures cells, not because it destroys tissue, but because it's the source of the energy for the distension. It's two or three orders of magnitude, or maybe even more, than you could explain by 0.3 cc's per minute flow. Except for CSF overproduction and DeRocco and Behring's experiments, you can explain every problem with hydrocephalus based on a bulk flow model. And what I want you to do is not throw me out, not throw bulk flow out, because you've got this new thing that you can see with your new imaging studies, and don't ignore the fact that there's an obstruction somewhere that you can define, and use your techniques to define that so that we can reclassify hydrocephalus. Thank you.
You know, since we want to put Richard Bank, et cetera, up on the spot.